Good morning, and thank you for joining me on the Path to Liberty. It's Monday morning, April 6th, 2020. Back in 1798, and I've mentioned this on this show many times, but James Madison warned us in a letter in May to Thomas Jefferson, saying, and in his words, that perhaps it is a universal truth that the loss of liberty at home would be charged provisions against danger, real or pretended, from abroad. And the way that we can apply that today is to acknowledge, to recognize that anytime there is a crisis, government politicians, bureaucrats, and supporters of the monster state will always try to use that time of fear and uncertainty to expand centralized power. Today's episode, we're going to go over one of the greatest emergencies in American history, that is the emergency, the Depression of 1929 and its aftermath. I'm just going to touch on that briefly, go over some highlights, and I think you're going to find it pretty interesting. First of all, my name is Michael Bolden. We broadcast live every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time from here in my home office and studio in downtown Los Angeles for the 10th Amendment Center. We have a bunch of different live streaming video platforms, YouTube, Facebook, DLive, Periscope, and Twitch. Plus, we have archived video platforms on Brighteon, Library, BitChute, and BitTube. We also have our audio-only podcast editions over at iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, Podbean, and elsewhere. You can find all of our archives, all the show notes, all the previous episodes, all those links that I talk about, platforms you can follow us on, ways to support us like our membership program for as little as $2 a month over at our show homepage over at 10thAmendmentCenter.com/Path to Liberty, all spelled out. Again, 10thAmendmentCenter.com/Path to Liberty. And this is really an episode that I'm learning as I'm going here. I've done some reading over the years, primarily at Mises.org and Fee.org, a little bit at the Cato Institute, but I've been learning more and more about this time, this period of Hoover, FDR, the New Deal, the new economic stylings of the Hoover administration, and the centralized control. And hopefully you guys will pick up some interesting stuff from this as well. But taking a look over in the live chat, I just want to say hello to everybody. I really appreciate you, whether you join me live or later on in the archives. So hi to Brilliant Radiance, Heather Rossi, Essential Freedom, Charity Berry, Idemon. Good to see you, buddy. He says that's a different look from Quiplash. I did a charity event that was hosted by Tom Woods with Michael Malice, Dave Smith, Angela McCardle. We did some fun Mad Libs. It was definitely an adult version of Mad Libs where they raised about $6,000 for New York City Meal on Wheels. That was really fun over the weekend. I'm glad you got to check that one out. Yo Mama, Michael Lure, Keith the Hat Guy, Tyler B., Clay Davis, good to see you, buddy. Andrew Nappy, good to see you as well. I appreciate you all spending time with me. Also want to say hi to, is that Loic and Dennis Marburger, good to see you as well. Anyways, let's get to this. This morning, as I was putting together my notes for this episode, I came across an article in the LA Times talking about how the crisis that we're in today is going to change the country in big ways, is how they put it in the article. It will change the country, change America in big ways. History says so. And this is how Mark Barabak, who I talked to a number of years ago for a few articles relating to the right to keep and bear arms and some nullification efforts, but he puts it this way. It's too soon to say before this crisis has crested, but how will it shape what becomes America's new normal? He says, changes to strengthen the public healthcare system. Mind you, the language is all kind of advocating for more government power, but just understand that this is the type of thing that we are should be expecting to face. Making it nimbler and better fortified seem likely. There may be new laws to address the disparity between salaried employees who enjoyed paid benefits and those who rely on freelance work to get by. Perhaps scientists and other experts will be more closely heeded when they speak of climate change and its dire effects. But he goes on, Mark says, but there is no doubt, given experience, that the political effects that we're facing today will be transformative and long-lasting. Not necessarily in partisan terms, those red versus blue lines seem too deeply entrenched, but rather in the way government touches our everyday lives. Now, look, government already touches our everyday lives in so many ways. They tell us what kind of light bulb we can have, how big our toilet can be. They literally have regulations on the size, the amount of water that your toilet is able to have, how you can defend yourselves and your family, whether or not you're able to, what kind of plants you can grow and consume in your own home. They touch our lives in every way possible already. And we're being told to expect it to get worse. Now, going to Jacob Hornberger, we published this article. It was originally posted over at Future of Freedom Foundation, FFF.org, somebody we've run his columns for many years here over at the TAC. But we ran this article, The 1929 Emergency Revolutionized America, back on April 1st. And it is not April Fool's, absolutely not. And this is how Hornberger put it. The stock market crash in 1929 provides an excellent example of how an emergency or crisis can be used to revolutionize a society permanently. Now, if we look at the LA Times column, the propaganda piece, they're saying, like, we should expect the way government touches our everyday lives. This is going to change. And of course, the changes we should expect should be an increase in how much they're touching us. Well, that might be best left for another episode of Quiplash with Tom and the gang. But anyway, so Hornberger is going on. He's basically saying this revolutionized society permanently. And he sums it up like this at the beginning. From the time the Constitution called the federal government into existence in the early 1790s until 1913, there was no Federal Reserve. The Fed was established in 1913, around 16 years before the 1929 crash. And of course, that was a very, very bad year. I'm not going to get into any details or explanation about how switching from a sound money system to the Federal Reserve system really created the bubble that caused that depression, that government caused it. I think there are other resources that you should check out for that. But let's go forward and see what they did in response. And I'm just going to go through some highlights here, and I got to look at my notes to see who I'm citing here. This is Hans Senholz, I believe, right? Hans Senholz over at Mises Institute, an article titled The Great Depression. Again, I will link to all of these. I've got a bunch of them for the show notes at 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty. This was published in June of 2009. It is just as important to read today as it was back then. And he starts out hammering on, or at least where I'm going to start out in his article, is hammering on the Hoover administration, because a lot of us are going to be quick to point out that FDR made things much worse and then, of course, revolutionized society. And we'll get back to Hornberger's article talking about that shortly as well. But Hoover really set the stage. This so-called free enterprise, free market guy, small government person was nothing of the sort. That is a lie. So check this out. The Hoover administration opposed any readjustment, any fixing of the economy or letting the economy readjust itself after it crashed. He says, under the influence of, quote, the new economics of government planning, the president urged businessmen not to cut prices and reduce wages, but rather to increase capital outlay, wages, and other spending in order to maintain purchasing power. It's a very similar approach that they have today. It's very Keynesian, has nothing to do with free markets. It is basically trying to control prices rather than having the market just do their own thing. Whether it's using government pressure or government force, the end result ends up being the same. Going further, Hans says, he embarked upon deficit spending. Wow, we got tons of that now, too. And called upon municipalities to increase their borrowing, spending debt for more public works. Of course, we need more infrastructure over and over and over. We're told that there has to be more infrastructure. Well, without savings, you shouldn't be building anything in the first place. So they have to cut spending in order if they're ever going to do this. Anyways, but Hoover went into massive deficit spending and wanted localities to do more borrowing so they could do more public works. Through the Farm Board, Hans writes, which Hoover had organized in the autumn of 1929, the federal government tried strenuously to uphold the prices of wheat, cotton, and other farm products. I mean, the mentality here, and of course we know later on, and I'm not really wasn't even planning on getting into this, but the federal government actually required people to destroy wheat at a time when supposedly people are dying of hunger in the streets during the Great Depression, at the worst times of it in the 30s. They're actually worried about prices being too low. I mean, if anything, when people are having a hard time, the best thing for them to purchase the essentials is the price to be lower. That's my personal opinion on it. Maybe someone can tell me how I'm wrong on that, but I think someone who really doesn't have any income or is very low, if their food products or the sources for them cost less, this is better. When oil costs less and gas can be cheaper so they can get from point A to point B as needed, that's better. High prices, stabilizing or requiring or pushing those prices up, I think benefits the politically connected. So going further, Hans writes, the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of June of 1930 raised American tariffs to unprecedented levels, which practically closed our borders to foreign goods. According to most economic historians, this was the crowning folly of the whole period from 1920 to 1933 and the beginning of the real depression. Now, interestingly enough, when Hoover was campaigning in 1932, I mean, not when Hoover and FDR were in this battle or when FDR was running for president, he wasn't running on a massive government plan. Just like so many politicians have done so with war and peace, when they run for office, they come out as interested in a humble foreign policy or more peace. And then when they get in office, it's totally opposite. We've seen this over and over and over, all the way back to World War I and probably before that as well, if I were really studying the history even better. But check this out from Gregory Bresiger, also at Mises.org. FDR, credited as the first major American politician to support a Social Security system, actually campaigned in 1932 in favor of limited government. FDR ran on a limited government platform, attacking the Hoover administration for being so insane. He bitterly criticized Herbert Hoover's huge deficits, writes Gregory, huge deficit spending, and attempts to bolster failing businesses with federal help. Basically, bailouts of the day. So FDR correctly criticized Herbert Hoover for deficit spending and protecting businesses rather than just letting them fail, having there be a correction. As Hans put it, Hoover was opposed to any readjustment in the economy, that is, allowing businesses who've been run poorly, even if it's through manipulation of interest rates based on the Federal Reserve, if they made bad choices on that, and when the crash comes in, those businesses need to go out of business so smarter people can come in and use those resources at a discount and create a better business in the future. So anyways, FDR was attacking Hoover on the campaign trail repeatedly. So he says he bitterly criticized Herbert Hoover's huge deficits and attempts to bolster failing businesses with federal help, some of which mirrored the ideas of the New Deal of a few years later. So he attacked them, and then he ended up implementing. What a scammer, right? Still on the campaign trail, FDR promised to roll back, not expand, the size of the federal government. This is a quote from FDR himself. He says, "For 3 long years, I have been going up and down this country preaching that government, federal government, state and local, costs too much. I shall not stop that preaching." In fact, the Democratic Party platform in 1932 called for a balanced budget, sound money, and a 25% reduction in federal spending. We wouldn't expect that from any major party today, but this was the Democrat platform of 1932. And maybe that's an argument to say that even in good parts of platforms that you may find today, it's a good reason to ignore them because platforms seem to be political statements. And when it gets down to the business of ruining people's lives, they don't give a damn about the platform, whether it says something positive or not. They're going to do what politicians do, and that is exercise power. So interestingly enough, he was running as a kind of a smaller government kind of guy because Hoover was going nuts. But going further, Gregory puts it this way. Yet even before he took office, FDR was quietly committed to a social insurance program as part of a program of counter-cyclical measures he believed would cure the problems of the business cycle. He thinks the problems were free markets, were the business cycle, there was no government intervention, no Federal Reserve problems. And then so therefore, if you start with the wrong issue in your mind, you're going to have the wrong solution. So many people have told us over the years that Hoover and the free markets and capitalism caused this, but Hoover was a big government goon. I don't know how else to put it. Now, going back to Hornberger's article, he puts it this way. Thus, when Roosevelt came to office in 1933, it was with the idea of, quote, saving free enterprise with free market reforms. Again, in quotes, I'm not sure if this is exactly from FDR or not, or maybe Jacob is just using some scare quotes to draw our attention. But either way, it's very interesting to me. In actuality, Jacob writes, what Roosevelt did was totally revolutionize America's economic system into something that was the precise opposite of free enterprise. And I focused on this particularly in last Friday's episode, my Fast Friday edition, talking about Executive Order 6102, which came on April 5th, 1933. I can't do the math. I went to government school, so I've got problems with that. But however many years ago yesterday, Executive Order 6102 to nationalize the gold holdings. And if you haven't checked out that episode yet, I encourage you to do that. I covered an article that Jacob wrote about that, along with some great history from Tom Woods, taking the gold, FDR's Executive Order 6102. I believe it's like 15 minutes. So you can really power through that. And then, of course, I have links in the show notes on that episode as well to Jacob's article, FDR's Tyrannical Gold Confiscation, and Tom's article, The Great Gold Robbery of 1933, which is now 12 years old. But again, just as good. A lot of the stuff that you find out there from a lot of these writers, you could read it anytime, any year, any decade, and it's the exact same message. And that consistency is what really draws me in. So again, if you haven't checked this out, this gold robbery is a good episode for you to follow up. So going back to Jacob's article again, he put it this way. Paper money now became the official money of the United States without even the semblance of a constitutional amendment. Even though the Great Depression ended decades ago, FDR's paper money standard continues to exist today, along with ever-increasing economic and monetary chaos and crises. So again, the whole idea that this type of thing in an emergency, a crisis, leads to permanent changes is correct. So even though I don't necessarily think I'm going to like what Mark Barabak says over at the LA Times on what he expects, probably what he personally wants, not to necessarily impugn on him some ideas, but in my personal conversations with him a couple of times years ago, I get the impression he likes bigger government. And the way he writes this article, you can read it for yourself too. I'll link it in the show notes. But he's absolutely right in that we should expect this type of crisis we're facing today to lead to potentially permanent ways that government is going to change and how it interacts with us. And that's basically what Hornberger is saying here as well. He's just saying, let me get this right link up here. He's basically saying that through this crisis, we went to a paper system. And because of that crisis, the paper system stayed forever. The old saying goes, you know, there's nothing more permanent than a temporary government program. Now, I'm not certain how temporary some of these programs were claimed to be, but they certainly, some of them were. And they never went away. We know the income tax was originally going to be a temporary wartime measure, a small percentage on the richest of the rich. And that certainly turned out far different as well. So Tom DiLorenzo had an article over at Mises.org as well, and he starts talking about the so-called First New Deal. This was 1933 and 1934. So once Roosevelt gets in, he campaigns on a smaller government. Things get thrown out the window pretty quickly. The so-called First New Deal, Tom writes, was one giant cartel scheme whereby the government attempted to enforce cartel pricing and output reductions in hundreds of industries and in agriculture. This, of course, was well documented in John T. Flynn's book, The Roosevelt Myth, first published in 1948. I haven't read this one yet, so if you have, I mean, Tom DiLorenzo has talked about this, I think, a number of times over the years, and I've seen this one listed. This is not one I've covered. I'm actually going to link to you as well a book recommendation list on this time from Mises. David Gordon put together a nice overview of a bunch of books where he gives a little bit of an overview of each of the books. I haven't read this one yet, but DiLorenzo recommended it. He also said that Henry Hazlitt had also written about it some 15 years earlier. So what is that, 1935? And quote, New Deal cartelization policies are a key factor behind the weak recovery, accounting for about 60% of the difference between actual output and trend output. That was in 1935 or 1933. So they were already aware that creating cartels were a problem. These days, the word cartel is seen as a negative. Maybe it was at the time then. I don't know. But they certainly really pushed that model to have a centralized control over everything. And it was a total failure and made things worse and worse and worse. And here's an article from Jonathan Feingold Catalan talking about how the Federal Reserve came in as well from 1933 to 1936 and pushed a very expansionary monetary policy. He writes it this way. The years 1933 to 36 saw an expansionary monetary policy pushed by the Federal Reserve and the federal government. Within that time period, the stock of money increased by 46% and the general price level by 31%. And those of you who understand, like I do, that inflation really isn't the increase of prices. People generally say inflation means your eggs are more expensive, or your milk costs more, or your toilet paper costs more, whatever it may be. But really, the reason that it costs more is because inflation is an increase of the amount of money in circulation. So when the Federal Reserve goes to the printing press and just blasts out way more money, you're going to have more dollars, more fiat currency, more paper money chasing the same amount of products. Because if you're not increasing the output of products at the same time, then eventually the prices go up. And it's a price in an increase of money. And generally, the people who get that printed money first are commercial banks. So the banks who get it, maybe they have loans or whatever it may be, they get it. And they get it before the prices that we see actually go up. So it's a double scam in that effect, because the price printing or the money printing that causes the prices to go up for us, the impact doesn't really affect the people who get it first. Because they get to spend it right away. That's another episode, I think, all on its own. But anyways, let's go back to Jacob Hornberger again. He's talking about the welfare state. So we have the monetary revolution. They ended the sound money system, and they went to a paper money system out of this crisis of 1929 through the late 30s. And then even after World War II, there is some great research out there that I haven't actually come up with the articles for today, but I just wanted to mention it. A lot of people think that World War II ended the Great Depression. That is actually incorrect. It still was going further. And war, if the only thing you can do to get out of an economic problem caused by government is to have the deaths of millions, that is not really a solution either. So Jacob goes on. He says, Roosevelt then used the economic emergency to convert the federal government into what is now known as a welfare state, a type of system in which people are forced to be good and caring to others. As James Madison told us, charity is no part of the legislative duty of the government. He was arguing against basically some kind of a bailout thing, taking care of other people. But he's like, this is not what the federal government is authorized to do, even if you like it. But instead, now people are required to do this. People are required. And then you have bureaucratic managers of that charitable money. And they have personal interests, or maybe they have financial backers that are going to direct it. You can't make a choice of where things are going to go, where your charitable contributions are going to go many times, because not a lot of us are earning a lot of money in this system to have excess savings. They're stealing so much from us, and then they direct where it goes. That is not a charitable system at all. Jacob goes on. He says, that was when Social Security was called into existence, a concept that had originated among socialists in Germany in the late 1800s. It is absolutely a socialist program, whether you, quote, paid into it or not. Paying into something under the force of a gun, if you don't pay into it, eventually they're going to come and lock you up, take your money, garnish your wages, whatever. That is not charity. That is not a retirement fund that you've chosen. That is a forced one. And although I agree that everyone should try to get as much money back as possible, this is not a charitable system. It is not a retirement fund. It is government theft through and through. Going further, Jacob puts it this way. Even though the economic emergency of the Great Depression turned out to be temporary, Social Security became a permanent part of American life. It is still with us today, along with countless other welfare state programs. We know, again, temporary government programs, temporary emergencies always end up being timeless, endless government programs to so-called fix these things. They create it as part of the society, and then when enough people start relying on it, any chance of reducing or getting rid of it goes to almost zero. No politicians have the backbone to deal with that at all. So then Jacob goes on two sections, the National Industrial Recovery Act, that's NIRA, and then his court packing scheme. Just briefly, I'm not going to really get into this, but I think you can read about it a little bit more on your own time. Basically, National Industrial Recovery Act was a fascist program. This is as Mussolini as America could have gotten at that time. And he put it this way. The NIRA was a system based on the concept of economic fascism. Oh, and he actually said this too. It would have fit perfectly in the fascist regime of Italian dictator Benito Mussolini. To ensure compliance with the new system, FDR employed a propaganda poster called the Blue Eagle. It placed business and industry into cartels and gave them the power to set their own prices and wages, labor conditions, and production of goods. But this was a federally controlled system, and surprisingly, the Supreme Court actually took an opinion against it, said it was unconstitutional. So what did FDR do? He was really pissed off about this. So he immediately went to this court packing scheme. He was going to stuff the courts with more and more justices so they would rule in his favor. But that hasn't really played out. We've seen some people call for that again in modern times, and that can only lead to very dangerous results. But here's how Jacob summed it up. So at least we are spared having to live under a fascist NIRA and under FDR's corrupt court packing scheme. Unfortunately, though, we are still saddled with a massive income tax and a tyrannical IRS, an enormous welfare state, an ever-growing warfare state, and a Federal Reserve that continues producing economic chaos and monetary destruction. See what emergencies can do to people's liberty and well-being? Jacob's absolutely right. He's following through. I don't know if it was even his intention, but he's certainly following through on the wisdom of the founders. John Dickinson put it this way in article or letter number 9, I believe, from Letters from a Farmer in Pennsylvania. This was 1767 and 1768, a series of 12 letters that he wrote in response to the hated Townsend Acts. And this was primarily talking about national defense. But he said, but I think it can be applied to just about anything. He says, the money said to be taken from us for our defense may be employed to our injury. So when they're taking money, taking control, taking power, taking your liberty, supposedly to protect you, to save you, to fix things, keep in mind that politicians, and Dickinson was pretty diplomatic, even when he was being hardcore. But basically he's saying like, look, just pay attention. They just might be using this in ways that they shouldn't be using in the future. And of course, I've warned over and over and over again, and I only warn based on the warnings that I've learned from the founders, whether it was Dickinson or Madison or Jefferson or George Washington or John Adams, doesn't matter, across that political spectrum, they warned us over and over and over. George Washington, specifically in his famous farewell address, 1796, said, "Let there be no change by usurpation." If you don't like the powers that the government has, and you think it needs to do something else, there is a way of doing that. That's called the amendment process. They built it into the Constitution. He says, but that let there be no change to the Constitution by usurpation, because even if you like the short-term results, I'm paraphrasing, he says, this is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. And just quickly to wrap this up, what I'm going to be blabbing about here, this is David Gordon. He wrote an article back in 2009, What You Must Read About the Great Depression. He goes through a whole list of things. The Roosevelt myth is one of them as well. Garrett, Salvos Against the New Deal. I'm sure he's got Bob Higgs, Jim Powell, FDR's Folly is one that I've read. Murray Rothbard wrote America's Great Depression. That's another one that I read that was amazing. A History of Money and Banking in the United States. I will link to this in the show notes. I think it's like 10, 15 books that he's included here. So we've got a lot of time to do some reading these days, or some of us do. So this is a great starting point that I encourage you guys to check out as well. But anyways, before heading out, I want to take a quick look over in the live chat and see if there's any quick questions. Keith the Hat Guy said, Social Security is a scam worse than Madoff's Ponzi scheme, as it is not voluntary. And I think that's really the big issue. If people want to contribute to something and they want government to do it, let it be voluntary. But of course, government programs can't be voluntary because they're built on the idea of using force and requirement. That's the same with Obamacare, the individual mandate. They didn't want it to be voluntary because they're like, you can't get enough unless you force people. And ideas that require force are not good ideas at all. Mike Gangstead says SS and Medicare fall under the income tax, which is an excise. If you're not receiving wages, which by IRC you should not be contributing to any of the three. I would like to see all of them ended. Absolutely. Bob Brewer says smashed from Tyler. Good to see you, Bob. Always good to appreciate your feedback and input. And then scrolling through this, Wall Street and FDR, Jesse Crum recommended a book by a guy named Anthony Sutton. I'm not familiar with that, but I appreciate that recommendation. If you've got a link to it, feel free to post that in the comments there on Facebook, and I'd be happy to take a look at it as later, and maybe other people can see that as well. Jesse Crum also says they do that now. Run on a platform the people want to hear. I think you're getting back to, this is going back in time a little bit in this episode, a few minutes, when I was talking about how FDR ran on a small government platform. George W. Bush ran on a humble foreign policy. Barack Obama, we saw, was the peace candidate. We see over and over and over these candidates run on things that people want to hear. They're good at this. Politicians are scammers. They're good at lying and convincing people to do stuff and raising money, and they're pretty dangerous. Anyways, Erwin Havranek says, DiLorenzo was great. Read many of his books. Yes, we've published a number of his articles here over the years. He wrote some great stuff on Lincoln. I finally got to meet him in person for the first time at the Tom Woods 1,000th episode celebration in Orlando, Florida a few years ago, and that was pretty awesome as well. And someone over on Twitch says Bill Gates is practicing medicine without a license, which is a crime. If we're talking about the government and their buddies, their corporate backers prosecuting themselves, I don't think that's that's probably not one that we can really rely on anyways. But I appreciate you guys joining me. I hope you guys found this really interesting. I hope you learned something. I'm learning a lot. So there's stuff that I knew in general here, but learning, like I had heard that FDR really flipped the switch. But to see the quotes in context, how he was running on a campaign of small government, it just turns that light bulb. I'm like, oh, yeah. My immediate thought is like, oh, yeah, here we go again. They all do this. And I think it's a great reminder to look with a very jealous eye, that's how Patrick Henry would have put it, at any statement in support of liberty from any politician running for office. We shouldn't trust them. It isn't trust, but verify. It is listen with interest and then prove it to us. That's it. Anyways, again, I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope you learned something. If you support us, you can join our membership program for as little as $2 a month over at 10thamendmentcenter.com/members. If you're not able to contribute financially, I understand it's very difficult for many people right now. There are many free things that you can do to support the show as well. Smashing the like, commenting, subscribing, leaving a review on iTunes or whatever other platform you may be listening on. All of these things trigger the algorithm of the platform that you are watching or listening on, and it tells those platforms to show the program to more people. So all of those easy free actions help us out a great deal. We are continually growing slow and steady, and we're going to continue doing this every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday as long as possible. Again, thank you for joining me. I hope you are safe, as happy, as healthy, and as stocked up as can be. And I'll see you next time here on the Path to Liberty.